Welcome to the third season of the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, the show where we talk history through pop culture. I'm your host, Eric Paul, and each week we'll be analyzing a movie, TV show, music album, or other media to determine what it can tell us about the time period from which it came. Jeremy from the Bigger Than the Game podcast is back for this, the first episode, and as things usually go between us, we talked about our topic for a good long while. ESPN, and more specifically SportsCenter, was what we decided to take the time to dissect, and we each had a lot to say about it. So it is broken into two parts, one today, and another that will be out next week. You can go over to Patreon or Substack, and as a paid subscriber, listen to the full, unedited episode. This is new this season. Also new for Season 3 is combining the short episodes, what I record with drop-in guests when I do the podcast live at festivals, parks. I don't just sit by myself in a park, usually there's something going on at the park. And museums, combining those with the full-length analytical conversation into one super episode. And that's where we'll start today. I set up a few times this summer on the grounds of Strawberry Bank Museum, a living history museum in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and had some museum guests stop by to be guests on my show. Trey, who is in his first semester of college, had some really unique thoughts about primary sources in general, so I had to record what he had to say. Take a listen. I'm here with Trey at Strawberry Bank Museum, and you are a freshman?
Incoming freshman, yeah.
Have you been to Strawberry Bank before?
I have. I came here in fourth grade and then again junior year as part of like a creative writing class. Came here to write poetry.
What a perfect spot for that.
Yeah.
You get so many great ideas and...
so much history and beauty here.
And stories and just everything.
Exactly.
And before I put the microphone in your hand, we were talking. We were like... I like the way you think. I'll just put it that way. If you don't mind just recapping what you were saying before I hit record, because you spoke directly to my heart on what you said about primary sources.
Yeah, of course. So we were talking about primary sources, and he was going into how everything is a primary source. All of the books on the table in front of me, all the books on this shelf. And I thought it was crazy to think about that this podcast will one day be a primary source to someone.
Yeah.
Maybe 20 years from now, 50 years, someday my voice here and his voice here could be a primary source that talks about this time period, both implicitly and explicitly. And I think that's just incredible to think about.
And like the more that we do digitally, everything, we just leave prints everywhere we go.
Absolutely.
What were you saying about when you take notes in class that you wonder someday? I've wondered the same thing too. When I was a student, especially, I'd be like, you know, and I don't, like a lot of New Englanders, we don't throw things out. So, you know, there's a good chance that what's going to happen someday to those notebooks.
So a lot of times when I'm taking notes in class, especially in history, I'll be like, someday my handwriting might be read by somebody else 50 years from now, and it would be considered a primary source to them. And like he said, I often hoard a lot of my notebooks. Mm-hmm. I have some on the shelf from freshman year and above, really. I just keep everything, and if everybody else keeps everything too, and we all kind of hoard all of our documents, then eventually other people could find them, and they could learn more about us and about our time and our culture, and I think that's
absolutely
kind of incredible.
Do you ever doodle in your notebooks?
So, I'm a doodler. I'm not an artist. I've never been taught how to draw, but I just kind of sketch things in my notebook sometimes, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's and those can be also, because like I doodle all the time, and I sometimes will come up with things just ridiculous looking, you know, they're not anything. But other times, like if I was to go back into my notebook, I guarantee you I'd find endless Star Wars battles going on, and you know, TIE fighters going everywhere. And so we're informed by pop culture in a big way, what we like to, you know, like, I don't know how many Ninja Turtles I've drawn over the years, just like in the corner of my notebooks or whatever. And I remember finding a book a couple years ago and I loved it. It was called Presidential Doodles. And it was basically what you're describing. People collected just, you know, from presidential papers and if they're in meetings and stuff like that, or letters from themselves to other people, the little doodles that they would put, all of them. And like some of them are kind of surprising, but they all seemed for the most part to match the time periods. Like Thomas Jefferson's were like really, you know, like mathematical equations and everything's correct and engineering type things. But then like Teddy Roosevelt has like drawings of his kids chasing after like, you know, turkeys and stuff. And he's like, what are, you know, and making funny remarks about him. So I think that, you know, especially, so you said you're going into, you're a physicist, right? You're going to,
hopefully someday.
And so when you become accomplished and you write lots of books and you give lectures and everything, they're going to find those notebooks and they're like, okay, this is Trey's stuff from when he was in high school and college. And we can see, you know, from that read into the world around him. And do you think that, cause you're going into college, is traditional note taking still part of what most students are doing?
So I know a couple of my classmates have been taking digital notes on their computers, but I've always preferred handwritten notes. There was a study I was doing a while back on meditation for my senior project, and I did a little semi-study within my study. Wow, I sound like a massive nerd, but anyways.
No such thing. That sounds like a brilliant thing, actually.
I was reading a few books for inspiration. One was The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. One was The Attention Revolution, and one was Mindsight. And for each book, I used a different method of note-taking. For one, I used sticky notes. For another, I used a physical notebook. And for one, I took digital notes on the computer. And I found that what I did with physical notes in like an actual notebook was the best for me in terms of retention and for doodling and just writing random thoughts, because I did tend to do that a lot. I was reading Mindsight at the time. It's a book written by a psychiatrist about a technique he's developed working in the field with his patients, and I thought it was really fascinating. And I guess I'm kind of going off topic a bit, but I think it's really interesting to me that there are so many ways of taking notes, and we keep trending towards physical note-taking as, I guess we're trending away from it now, but we're still going back to it as like a staple because it's so effective and it lets us convey so much more than, say, numbers on a keyboard or letters on a keyboard.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think that when I go to meetings or whatever I might be taking a note on, I will favor even just scrap paper and a pen over, you know, because like, you can lose that pretty easily, but on these computers, you can also lose a lot of stuff. If you don't, you know, say you run out of battery and you didn't save it. And I mean, those things can evaporate just as quickly. You know, the hard drive crashes, you know, it's like you lose all that stuff. Whereas, like, don't they say like the more senses that you use to study or to take notes, the more you're likely to retain it.
I've heard that,
versus if you're just clicking and clacking and you have like 25 tabs open on your, you know, you're just distracting yourself like crazy. You know, like there's writers that will refuse to use like a internet connected computer device because they know that they're just going to end up.
It's a distraction.
Yeah, they're just going to go down to some rabbit hole and forget what they were typing about. And, you know, a typewriter might actually be the best thing to use.
And it is interesting to think about because a lot of the times digital mediums are considered more permanent because they're saved in so many places.
Right.
But if in 1,000 years the internet isn't what it was before, or even doesn't exist entirely, all we'll have is the physical notes that we take. We won't have any of those digital copies anymore. So
you're right, because digital hasn't proven itself like the written word has as being long lasting. And
I think it definitely has the potential to be long lasting, but it isn't a guarantee so much as the traditional pen and paper.
And at least it's like start with that. Like I used to tease my mom in the early days of internet and email. Because she would go to the computer at the library and to write her emails, and she would have spiral notebooks full of her. She would write it out by hand first, then go and sit down at the, you know, she'd sign out the computer for the half hour or whatever and type it all out. And we teased her. We're like, email's supposed to be a little bit more quick and informal. And, but she's like, but this is just how I know how to write letters. But what works out is she has, therefore,
a copy of everything she sends.
Like those emails, I don't even know if I still have the same email address that she was sending them to me. So they might be long gone, but the physical ones, that's the correspondence that matches up. You know, I was talking to a gentleman a little while ago and he was talking about reading diaries and journal entries from family members. People don't do that anymore. No. And a lot of it is because we, in our mind, are like, oh, well, you know, I just, it's in my email. It's in my, I'll put a post on Facebook. And, but that, you know, it's really hard to, like, Facebook has to remind you of things. Like, you can't just, like, dig through your Facebook necessarily and find, you know, all these posts as quickly and easily. And it's a lot more enjoyable to read a book than it is staring at a screen.
I definitely agree. People have been trying to convince me that audiobooks are the way to go, but I love the feeling of, like, a physical book in my hand.
Yeah.
It just feels a lot more real.
Well, just your great point to make is, look at how long those e-readers lasted. You know, like, those were, the, like, about 10 years ago, they're like, oh, everyone's, you know, books, no more books, just e-readers. And, like, that lasted maybe about 2 years before people were like, no, regular books are fine.
I do agree that e-readers are more convenient, but I do find that I enjoy reading normal books a lot more.
Yeah, because they had to incorporate into some of those the sound of a page turning, you know, just to make people feel like they're mm-hmm. reading some more. I'm like, well, why don't you just... I remember the author Avi. Do you ever read Avi's books?
I don't believe so.
He does a lot of historic fiction. That's why I like him so much. Great author. I saw him talk in Boston some years ago, right around the time e-readers were becoming popular. And people were like, they asked his opinion as an author and a reader. What do you think these e-readers are a new thing? And he's like, well, honestly, I don't see how inconvenient it is to take, like, 3 paperbacks and throw them in your duffel bag if you're going on a trip. Mm-hmm. And he's like, they don't run out of batteries. You know, your eyes aren't going to strain from looking at it. You know, it's like they've proven themselves for, I'd say, close to 600 years now.
Yeah.
So I think we can say that that's a more sure way to go for our chronicling of stories and ideas.
And going off of the convenience of normal books, I'm coming off of a week-long trip as part of the Hamel Scholarship,
mm-hmm.
and I brought with me a 1,200-page tome that I honestly didn't have any trouble lugging around, so it's definitely doable in modern society to bring books places. It's not a lost art.
It's not, and it's one I think if people... We live in an era of trends, you know, and if you're willing to not... I mean, I'm saying this as I'm podcasting right now, but we live in an era of trends, and they come and go so quickly that if mm-hmm. we have people that... at least keep one foot in the tried and true, you know, we will probably return to it. You know, people are like, I understand. Books, that's not so hard to go like this. You know,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, hand by your side. Trey, thanks so much for stopping by. And
of course.
I'm glad I got, you have a group of about 8 guys, and I got one of you to join me. But I appreciate your courage, and you had a great thing to talk about, and I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I've learned from a college history professor that she has her students listen to the first episode of this podcast, which is called A Word About Primary Sources, before they launch into document research. But this conversation with Trey may need to be added as required listening. The Entertainment and Sports Programming Network, or ESPN, and its main show, SportsCenter, predate me by about 18 months, and I didn't really start tuning in until the 1990s when I was around 12 or 13. That's the era Deremy and I focus on in the podcast that you're about to hear and refer to as the show's heyday. But of course, the foundation for ESPN and SportsCenter's success was laid in the late 1970s and throughout the 1980s. It was then that cable television was rapidly taking over as the go-to for American households seeking out entertainment and information.
Season 3, episode 1 of the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. I'm Eric Paul, and I'm joined today by Deremy, who is the co-host of the Bigger Than the Game podcast. And welcome to the show. Welcome to the Pop Shop. I know listeners can't see anything, but this is my new podcasting locale, and I'm glad to be recording my very first episode here with you. Welcome to the show again.
No, thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure to be on with you, man, because I've gotten so many good reviews about when we did that Super Bowl I episode, which was really fun to do with you. And I'm pumped for this topic, and I'm pumped. I'm loving the new digs. It looks pretty good. So
and you can only see a little bit of it. My light up Santa Claus back here is like blinding the screen a little bit, but I had to put him in here. I feel like every pop culture place needs a vintage light up Santa Claus. It's just like
it wouldn't be complete without it.
Right? Exactly. It's incomplete without him because you know he brought so many of these things to us. But on the other time of the year, so we were just talking. Before hitting record about our topic for today and how it says for me, I always think of summertime, especially when I was growing up as a 12, 13, you know, young teenager. ESPN Sports Center is our topic, and we're going to be dissecting that today and seeing what it tells us about. I think we're going to be focusing on that sort of the golden years of SportsCenter, which would be the 1990s. We can talk a little bit about its formation, but in many ways, it's almost like a sequel to our conversation about Super Bowl I, because mm-hmm. as you pointed out in that episode, that was, you know, NFL football really came into its own thanks to television. And SportsCenter and ESPN in general is very much the story of cable TV and how cable opened up a big wide world of sports, not to borrow a name from another company, to all of us. Like our understanding of the sports world and our love of sports. I know I personally can credit ESPN and SportsCenter in particular with a lot of what I care about and know about sports. How would you rank SportsCenter as far as its importance to you, considering also that you host a sports podcast?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And I think you're right. It's important. Like the 90s is probably the heyday for ESPN SportsCenter. But, you know, even with the formation, and you made a great point, looking at what cable TV was in the 80s and 90s and how it grew, I think there's two networks that really define that, and that's ESPN and MTV. Those two networks, if you think about the explosion of cable television, those two networks kind of like are the defining things that show like how this whole, we went from the three network system to this big cable TV boom. But for me, like you said, I don't think I would be doing the podcast that I've been doing the past 3 years without ESPN and SportsCenter. My love of broadcasting, my love of communication. A big part of that was twofold, listening to local sports talk radio, but watching ESPN SportsCenter and this new way, especially it started in the 80s with Chris Berman, but the 90s, it took off with this new way of delivering sports commentary and doing highlights that we hadn't seen before.
Yeah. And the way that it just like became incorporated into some people's routine. And that's why I always think about summertime, because when I was probably like 11 or 12 years old, I got a paper route. That was my, my job, and probably for a little bit too long. I think I was 18 when I finally gave it up, but, it was kind of nice in some ways because I would be done my work day by 6:30 in the morning. And in the summertime, like, so the rule was we had to get our papers out. I think 6:30 was the cutoff. So I would get up, you know, summertime a little bit later than the rest of the school year, and I'd get all my papers delivered, and then I'd be home by 7 a.m., and I would immediately turn on SportsCenter just to catch up on the previous day's highlights and get all my scores and everything. And then fast forward a couple years later, I was in college, and I remember distinctly one of my friends in college was like huge sports guy, you know, loved all the sports. He didn't, you know, he wasn't a snob about any of them. And he just said it so plainly one time. He's like, yeah, I just got to get my scores and my highlights and then I'll go to bed. You know, just like, like, you know, it's on the list of things to do, like brush your teeth, you know, let the dog out, you know, not that we had dogs in college dorm, but you know, all those things you do before bed. And he's like, get my highlights, get my, you know, score. Cause SportsCenter is like always there, you know, kind of like MTV, at least in the '90s, had blocks of videos. Like when all else fails, so just throw an hour long of the latest videos on. ESPN was the same way. It's like, well, we don't have anything else going on, you know, like the Tour de France. It was in the night. I remember that in the 90s, like in this, when it was going on in July, I was like, oh God, we got to watch Tour de France again. You know, how many times can we, how many of these guys can we get watch, you know, getting off their truck and cycling for the day? But SportsCenter was it. Cause that was, I mean, coincidentally, cause we were talking about how football kind of usurped, baseball in fandom because of television. But I loved summertime because you had all those MLB games the night before and you just got to watch the highlights of them, you know, every throughout the summertime. And I'd be eating my breakfast or whatever, you know, watching and hearing all of the different commentary. And I just thought it was wonderful. I mean, of course I watched it throughout the whole year, but for me, it was always like one of those things with summer.
No, I agree. Like you're right. You watch it throughout the whole year, but when you were in school, you know, the bus came at 7:15. So, you know, there was a hard out, like, all right, like you got to a certain point and you're eating cereal, you got to put it away, you got to run and catch the bus. The summertime was huge because you're right. Baseball. So our show, we recently did an episode on Ken Griffey Jr. Ooh. And him being out in the West Coast. You know, you would sometimes miss those highlights. You weren't up late enough for the 11 o'clock Sports Center. So the next morning you're getting it. But then for us, this was a whole new way of how sports were delivered. You know, our local news station, it was for a few minutes and it was very serious. The Phillies beat the Braves today 5-4 and so-and-so hit a home run and the Sixers will play tomorrow. And back to you, Bob. And that was really it. Where this was, it was a mix of seriousness, but then they were funny. They were irreverent. It was all kinds of things. And so for like me and my older brother watching it in the summertime, we would keep rewatching it and we knew the jokes and we knew the one-liners and we couldn't wait until, when Dan Patrick says in fuego or Stuart Scott has his lines. So like it became just watching it and then you're saying all these lines and. You know, and I'll probably talk about him more later, but when Stuart Scott passed away, it was kind of the biggest thing of realizing how much this show meant to me and so many people. And all those people who were on ESPN SportsCenter in the 90s were on each other's radio shows talking. Mm-hmm. And Dan Patrick said it best. He kind of said what you said, Eric, which is we didn't realize we were in people's homes in their bedrooms. That was the last thing they were watching were me and Keith, or they're waking up watching Rich and Eisen and Stuart Scott. And that's such a personal thing is like, that's the last thing before you go to sleep is you're watching SportsCenter. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's why you're a big part of so many people's childhood and memories. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really key. And that's why we kind of still yearn for that.
I'm so glad you brought up Stuart Scott because I was thinking about him earlier today before, you know, we got on. I was like, here's I could go through like the list of the lineup of, and I don't know exactly behind the scenes how they did it, but when I would turn it on the half hour, I always like got a kind of a little bit of like, excitement of like, who's going to be hosting it today? You know, right. I wonder if like they rolled the dice kind of, or like, okay. You know, today it's going to be Steve Levy and, you know, Keith Olbermann or something, and just the two of them. But the way they worked off each other a lot of times, I mean, I know for a fact that we, on my baseball teams and stuff, incorporated a lot of the lines from SportsCenter into like our infield chatter. You know, we would say things to our pitcher or even in the dugout that we definitely got from watching SportsCenter. And, one of my favorite lines, and it came from basketball, was, you can't stop them. You can only hope to contain them. You know, you know, third string backup finally came into the game. And, you know, they had those wonderful, you know, very just quick wit, you know, very funny type stuff. Never listened to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. Welcome. the way it works here is I'm a high school teacher, and I spend a lot of the time in my classroom working with treating everything as a primary source. In other words, a document of history. And for the podcast, what we do is we go through a template of questions, just like something that would be entered into a museum would be asked about. So who made it? Why did they make it? What was the motivation? Where did they make it? Things like that, to try to figure out what it tells us about a particular time period and the society that, in this case, watched the show and enjoyed the show and really kept it on the air, because if nobody watched, they would stop making it. So I'm going to actually leap ahead, because I feel like we're kind of circling around this question, because we're talking about how important it was to our youth, that growing up, we were watching it. Do you think that that age group, you know, we're talking like tweens to teenagers, was the intended audience of SportsCenter? Or do you think they were looking for something a little bit older?
I think they were looking for something older. I think it kind of, by happenstance, it hit to our younger. I think the sweet spot that I see is in the 90s, a lot of people who were college age and into their 20s really took off with it, and especially the big show combo of Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann.
Yeah.
But I think the happenstance, what I think even those 90s anchors didn't think about was, you know, I heard Rich Eisen say it, you're the 2 a.m. Sports Center, but then you're being re-aired, because they were like, and that's how I know they we weren't the intended audience, because at first it was, I'm the 2 a.m. Sports Center, and as an anchor, they're disappointed. I'm on at 2. But what they realized later on is what we're saying. They were on at 2, but then guess what? Replayed at 3, 4, 5, 6. So all the way until like lunchtime the next day, they're being re-aired and re-shown. And so it was like, oh, in happenstance, we got to know Rich Eisen better, got to know Stuart Scott. Craig Kilborn would do that sometimes, different people. And we got to know these guys because they're being replayed for 8 hours. Right. The big show at 11 is like 11 to 12 or 11 to 1, and that's it. 6 o'clock SportsCenter is right before the games, and then that was it. So the audience was intended to be that 18 to 25, that adult, but they got that audience, but they also got the young people too.
And in a way, it kind of worked out better for kids, because I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, anything that had like teen or kid or junior was like immediately dismissed. Like I didn't want anything to do with it, because you're talking down to me. You're making me feel
absolutely.
Because they had like Sports Illustrated for kids. I'm like, I could handle most of regular Sports Illustrated. I didn't need
exactly
the watered down version. Like, did you know that a football field has 100 yards? I'm like,
yeah, I hated that.
I don't need that. I want it. And so it was like, yeah, they didn't make it for us, but we gravitated towards it because it was not inappropriate for us by any means. And we felt cool because they were talking to us as, you know, because they didn't know. I mean, that's the beauty of broadcasting, is you don't know who, anybody can listen to it. Anybody can watch it. You know, you don't have to, it's just who they're intended for. So we got a special, and I have a quick theory. I think I mentioned this to you last time, but not recorded, but I have a theory that a lot of mechanics, playing styles for young kids, teenagers and a little bit younger, were influenced heavily by SportsCenter specifically, because we were watching the highlight reels. And I know for a fact that when we would, like my entire baseball team in the summer, we would watch SportsCenter in the morning, you know, not all together, but like, you know, individually. And I remember like the way I wore like the sweatbands on my, you know, arms and the batting glove, even the batting stances. We were borrowing from watching highlights, and I know that like a lot of first basemen would really not. I remember when I first got playing first base in high school, we had to have a coach work with me about proper first base mechanics, because I was always watching the very end of the play, because they don't see a first baseman setting up when you're watching.
Yeah.
you know, highlights of like a double play or something like that on television, you'd ever see the first baseman jogging over to his base and setting his feet. You always see the end of the play where he's in his stretch. And so many like 12, 13-year-old first basemen, I would see this all the time in the age of, you know, 90s Sports Center, before the ball was even thrown, already in the legs spread, you know, like stretch, waiting for the ball this way, which I did the first couple times I played first. And then the coach was like, no, you got to know where the ball's going first. And then you move to, you know, get the ball. And I was like, I bet you a whole generation of us had that same problem because we're watching the highlights and, you know, the shortstop is throwing like his favorite shortstop on SportsCenter. And then you want to be the cool first baseman making that, you know, long, big like splits basically to get to the guy right before he, you know, hits the base. And I'm like, how many lessons have we had to learn because we were so like, daily viewers of SportsCenter?
Oh, all the time. I think on twofold, it's a few generations now. What the highlight has done, I think in positive, it's been more entertaining for fans. I think it's got players more money. So those are the positive. The negative, and you brought up in baseball, I think about basketball all the time. How many people growing up with looked at the slam dunk? They could dunk. They're 5'11", 6 foot. They did exercises to help them dunk, but they couldn't hit a free throw or a jump shot to save their life. But they wanted the highlight was the dunk. So everyone was trying, how high can you get up and jump? And so I think in so many times, not knowing the – I think we see it today now with Steph Curry in the three-point shot. Now everyone doesn't want – they just want to learn how to shoot from half court. And I'm like, whoa, 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 like – that's not where you start. You don't just start off shooting half court doozies here. But I think in the negatives, it's how it influences how we play the game and also how we talk about the game. Yeah. Those two things I see for better and for worse. Like a lot of times these shows and these highlights, kids are going out and just trying to get that big dunk or that big shot or that big block. And they're not learning the fundamentals and also how we converse about sports. Now we see it with the whole art embrace debate and people like that's how they think like that's the way to get on or that's how we talk about sports. We have to be contrarian and yelling all the time. So to me in twofold, that's where ESPN and SportsCenter really impacts the sports fan.
It created sports fans. It made a different kind of sports fan. You're absolutely right about that. I suppose the audience question that we just answered, no matter how you shake it, no matter – it really informs us of a pretty significant leisure society in the 90s. All around the country, there were, you know, again, like summertime. That whole idea of summer vacation from school, I mean, I'm not going to argue with it because I like it. I enjoy it still today, but it's pretty antiquated. You know, it's from like – the 19th century when, you know, the farm needed lots of kids working on it, you know, right, in the summertime to get by. Like, we probably could, again, I'm not advocating for this, but we probably could have, you know, year-round school and just have, like, nice breaks, you know, like 2 weeks at a time every few months. But that had become so part of the culture by the 90s. Like, I have such – and it's because I was the age I was. I have such, like – wonderful memories of summer in the 90s. Like you couldn't wait to whatever the next big blockbuster movie was coming out. And yep, McDonald's was going to have some kind of contest to go along with it. And if they didn't have that, they had the Monopoly board to complete, which you know you're going to get. Like today, today I'm going to get Boardwalk and Park Place. And, you know, they had, you know, another, like they said, big action movie Coke commercials were fun. They had those, you know, again, the contest, you twist the bottle to, you know, and see what you won underneath it. And like all this stuff was just like, it meant summer, and ESPN was part of that because it informed so much of our, you know, the pickup games and the organized sports we were playing. So, and then for the older audience, the same thing. I mean, we were, by the 90s, everybody had access to TVs, sometimes multiple TVs in a house.
Mm-hmm.
Cable TV was not as exclusive as it was, you know, 10 years before. And another reason that we're not talking about ESPN and SportsCenter from the very beginning, because then it was a novelty. By the 90s, it was pretty accessible by most people. There was very few people like, we don't really watch that. It's like almost every American household had cable access, and you could watch ESPN.
And only to jump in real quick, the numbers that I saw later on, not only was it that everyone had cable by the 90s, a lot of times the main reason why people got cable was ESPN.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at the numbers, ESPN, as far as a media company, one of the amazing Cinderella out of nowhere stories in American history. Like, a lot of people, that's why I say ESPN, MTV too, but a lot of times, like, ESPN was the reason why everybody kind of had it. Like, every package, the main thing was, I want this cable package. I got to have ESPN. And it's like, well, you can get ESPN with this package, but with this package, ESPN and ESPN 2 or an ESPN Classic and all this. Oh, all right, I'll take that packet. Like, that was what cable companies were like using ESPN to lure families in to get cable.
Because sports in general, I think, is the big difference maker when it comes to that was about 10, 15 years ago when everybody started cutting the cable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coincidentally, that was the thing that gave most people pause. It was like, how am I going to be alienating myself from the sports world? Because I need, you know, football season comes around, you want to be able to watch, at the very least, highlights. Like, I was in a spot probably about 5 years ago where I didn't have, like, where I live, we couldn't even get the digital, you know, satellite or whatever you call it, the high def, you know, box didn't work. Like, I couldn't get any cable or any channels that way, and I didn't have money for the cable and blah blah blah. I ended up just getting on my Roku the NFL app, and it was actually kind of fun watching it because you're watching people watching the games, you know, so you wouldn't actually get to watch too much of the actual games, but it usually had a couple like former players and a few other NFL you know, .com tape people just hanging out in like a living room type setting. And if it was they would put that on, but they were
The Manning cast before the Manning cast, the way it sounds.
Exactly. It was, and I lived with it. Cause I'm like, well, this is better than nothing, you know? And it was kind of fun in a way because it was like hanging out with friends watching the game, but they can't actually see or hear you. They're just hanging out too. But it was a good replacement. Things have come back around, so you don't have to do that anymore. You know, NFL is super accessible. Everything is all put into packages. But during that sort of like purgatory, you know, or like in between the cable cutting world and streaming taking over everything, that's what I was reduced to. But I really missed the ESPN experience because I'm like, if I had had access to SportsCenter, I don't think I'd need that at all. Because I could just get my highlights, you know, Monday morning and, you know, see what happened in all the games and stuff like that.
Right.
So we're going to jump back up to the first question that is on the template. And that is the material it's made from and how it's made. And I think, you know, we don't have to get into the actual, like, idea behind ESPN and SportsCenter. That will come up in a few minutes when we get into who made it and why'd they make it. You couldn't ask for, I don't want to say easy because I'm sure it's not. I've seen, you know, the satellite dishes in Bristol, you know, they had to collect constant flow of sports and edit them down and get the scripts written up and everything like that. So not easy, but as far as like the mission for the actual show, the material's right there. It's called the professional sports world and the college sports world. You know, they don't have to like scavenge for content every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Except like the end of February. That's always like the worst time to watch SportsCenter. But do you think that there's the material it's based on, you know, is there anything more to that than just the sports in general?
Like, I just want to make sure I get it. So like how it like, you mean like how it kind of is created or what it's based, like what they're talking about?
Like, I guess when the, both the original concept behind it and then, cause like we were saying that like a local sports caster,
right.
Which I kind of have a feeling ESPN SportsCenter's more or less phased those out. Like they're not, like when I watch like the Boston, you know, news channels and stuff like that, they don't have a sportscaster anymore. They just like kind of refer to the Red Sox game. And if something major happened in one of the other like camps or something, they'll mention it, but they don't really have a guy. It's like, hey, I'm so and so and I'm here with the scores, as much as they used to. And so like the material that they, the local sportscaster, you know, on the nightly news, their material is whatever high school games happen that day, or if there's a professional team in town, what happened there. That's what they're based on. For ESPN SportsCenter, it's almost like they have too much to work with, wouldn't you say? It's like,
well, now, but that's not how it started,
right?
If you want to, so that's why I wanted to make sure. So how it started was which sounds crazy now, ESPN and SportsCenter, people were like, just like the way when CNN started, it was like news all day.
Yeah.
So it's like sports all day, 24 hours. What? And they were an upstart, so they didn't have all the rights to every, like now they're the main person, well, main network getting the rights. But in the 80s, they were actually like a laughing, like David Letterman used to like make fun of them because all they had the rights for, kind of like what we were saying earlier was like, you know, these like sailing and different random things like that.
Roller derby.
It was a big deal for a big thing that helped ESPN and with it SportsCenter was in the mid 80s getting like the Big East in college basketball. So then you would have the Big East, you know, Monday game of the week at 8 o'clock and you get, you know, Georgetown and St. John, this big matchup. And then right after, hey, we're leading in the SportsCenter. So as they started growing, and then you look at, I think it was 87, they get their first NFL package. And that's when NFL primetime with Chris Berman and Tom Jackson gets created. And those things kind of help grow SportsCenter because, all right, you have a big audience now coming, and then that audience will stay with you. Once the game's over, you're hyping up, hey, stay tuned for the highlights, SportsCenter next.
Yeah,
that kind of carries it. So though that's where it kind of grew, but at first it wasn't. In the 80s, CNN had their like sports night with Fred Hickman. That was beating the 11 o'clock sports center with like Chris Berman for a long time. Like CNN was number one with showing highlights. Like it's kind of like bizarre now to think of it, but that's how it was.
Because I think about, in those early days, they would have to kind of scrounge a little bit to find things to put on there because they just didn't have access to it all. And what we were saying before about the culture, and that's, I guess, the nature of a TV series, and especially one like this, it's nightly and all year round. It's not like they have seasons to it. But at first, when it first arrives, it's responding to, it's reflecting the culture. But then after a while, they do start informing the culture. But they're still reflecting it too. So it's like this weird, like two-way mirror kind of thing happening for, in this case, SportsCenter, which, and even sitcoms have the same thing. Like when I was talking about Seinfeld, in season one, it was, you know, the original Seinfeld is a product of the 80s. By the time you get to the later seasons, it's, yes, a product of the 90s, but it's also informing culture a lot.
Right.
So it's doing a little bit of both. So it's having that effect. And SportsCenter is the same way. So, but material wise, going back to Seinfeld, it's almost like I had that eureka moment before my very first episode of this show where I'm like, material isn't just the actual physical thing. It's also, it's like a comedian is like, they stole my material. Like I'm basing my jokes on something. And a lot of those SportsCenter's sportscasters, It reminded me a lot of like watching America's Funniest Home Videos in the same time period, where they would add that it wasn't just showing things and saying, like you said before, like the boring sportscaster and like, hey, the Phillies won today. You know, here's a couple highlights of Mike Schmidt, you know, hitting a home run. It was like having their own personal pizzazz added yes. to it, and their little catchphrases and, you know, describing what you're seeing. So they have like analysis, recap, you know, projections all rolled into one, and they have to cut it down to the right, you know, because they want to make it exciting because they know that most people weren't watching all the games. So like when you didn't want to see, they would always set up a great highlight reel of coverage of a game by not giving away who won with the first highlight, like the pregame mm-hmm. you know, stuff. And then they're like, all right, you know, fifth inning, we see, you know, then they oh, okay, it's starting to get good. And then, you know, then sometimes they're like, oh, I had no idea that the Brewers were going to pull that one off because they told such a great story throughout. So it's almost like the material for SportsCenter every single day was these little, like, it was a challenge for them. I bet, and I'm sure it still is.
Well,
to take a long, sometime like 2 to 3 hour long story of a game and compress it into 3 minutes.
So now I it's interesting you said what you said, because a lot of it is based off of, you're talking about like that source material or influenced.
Yeah.
And if you watch the Sports Center from the 80s, the Sports Center that we grew up loving, if you look at it, they're all like, and it's funny how this has influenced so much of this person has. It's the child of David Letterman. So you watch what Letterman did in the 80s on late night with Letterman, especially like that was his heyday. And what he's doing is he's doing a late night show, but it's like turning it upside down. And it's like it's like a parody of a late night show,
but
it's still a late night show. So then you look at like all those guys who are doing SportsCenter, from Berman, who gets hired, you know, when it starts, and then Tom Meese and Greg Gumbel, to the guys who we loved with, you know, Kilborn. Hey, Craig Kilborn later on hosted a late night show.
Yeah,
but Dan Patrick, Keith Olbermann, what they're doing is they know sports, they're knowledgeable about it, but they're having fun with it. They're being irreverent. They're kind of mocking the traditional, hey, look at me, and I'm important because I'm on TV in a suit and I'm delivering sports. And that serious, like the way we looked at Howard Cosell and Jim McKay back in the day, no disrespect to them, they were doing that Letterman thing, which is like, we know sports, we love sports, we can get serious when need be, but we're going to have fun with it, and we take the job seriously, but we're not taking ourselves seriously, and that's what we hadn't seen before. And that was like the mind-blowing, kind of like the way we would goof off with our friends, they were doing that on national television.
And never going so over the top, because then there's always like the sports shows, usually on like radio and stuff, that have goofy sound effects and, you know.
Right.
You know, it's like they didn't go that far, but they kept that nice, comfortable. And I still listen to Dan Patrick now and then. He has a very similar culture on his radio show of, you know, just kind of like having fun with it, taking it seriously, but not so serious and not doing too lighthearted. I guess now that you mentioned the David Letterman connection, makes the top 10 plays, that made much more sense.
Yeah.
You know, because he was always doing top 10s on his show.
Exactly.
And it also, you know, another thing from similar time period, sort of building the blocks of the style that they cultivated. You know, this week that we're recording this, Paul Rubens just passed away. Mm-hmm. And Pee Wee's Playhouse was the same kind of thing. It was a kid's show, but just like a satire of a kid's show, but it still was a kid's show. You know, it's like still had the same template is Captain Kangaroo and all those shows from like the 50s and the 60s, but just modernized, super weird, super fast paced, you know, to match what kids were looking for in the 80s. And then SportsCenter, I mean, I guess almost in a weird, this is a weird image, the idea of Pee Wee passing the baton to Dan Patrick or something, but like in a way, because that's how I, you know, I was born 81, so I was like kindergarten age when Pee Wee was in, you know, at his, the height of his thing. But then when I outgrew watching Saturday morning cartoons, it was just the perfect age to start watching SportsCenter. And, you know, it's like they kind of picked up and led me to the next phase of my life when,
yeah,
by the time I was like in college, like 99, 2000, I was watching the late night shows, you know, the talk shows, because I'd stay up late and watch Conan and, you know, all, and Saturday Night Live on Saturdays and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what an exciting college career I had. But I'm staying in watching shows again. But, you know, that's it's like now it's all starting to make sense. And it says something also about, once again, the power of cable. And so now for the next couple questions, I think we are going to have to go back to the origin place. And that is, who made it and why did they make it? So there's a couple names involved with the founding of both ESPN and SportsCenter. One of them is very familiar to anybody who's ever taken a poll, and that'd be Rasmussen. And the other ones is Chet Simonson, right? Or
Chet Simmons.
Simmons, yeah. Thinking of myself too much. Chet Simmons with SportsCenter specifically. And those names, especially Simmons, also brings it into the geographical component of it. But what is all of both the timing, who made it, and why did they make it? Let's talk about that a little bit and see what that tells us about like that turn from the 70s to the 80s when cable was really taken off.
Yeah, I think cable, just like a lot of things, just like the internet, podcasting, when cable came out, and you can see it, James Andrew Miller, who wrote the oral history of ESPN, he also did HBO. It was a new frontier, so people didn't know what it was. So that's where you get guys like a Ted Turner, who I want to make 24-hour news cycle, like station. And like nowadays, it's like, of course, why didn't everyone think of that? Back then, you know, it was the three, you have to look at it. It was three networks and they were just getting past the, like a little bit past where like at 10 o'clock, it was just the American flag waving and it would be that until 6:30 in the morning. Like that's kind of, they were still like evolving from that. And then it's like, oh, we got Johnny Carson now. And then once he's done, we go to bed or something and Tom Snyder. So it was still his Wild West. So then you have people kind of saying like, who are working at ABC Sports or these other places and kind of wanting to break out, like, well, here's this new wide open world of cable TV. Why not start and try a 24-hour network? And hey, we don't have all the rights yet. Where can we set up? You know, I've been to Bristol Connect. I've driven by it and I heard the stories and there really is, there's nothing there.
Yeah. It's like a working nothing class, in, you know, town.
Yeah. It's like open fields. So that's where they camped out. And it was, and it looks a lot better now than it did when they started in 79, but they needed that flagship show to kind of give those highlights. And that's where, you know, I think it was Lee Leonard who kicked it off, with SportsCenter in 79. But the way it started was it went by seasons, and probably what everyone would say is the most important person in SportsCenter history came around 1987, and that was John Walsh, who was this traditional newspaper guy who had worked for Rolling Stone and the Washington Post. Didn't have really a background in TV, but if you see, once he got in there and then his effects afterwards on SportsCenter and other shows, he treated it like that 60 Minutes magazine show where instead of, hey, it's football season, we're going to start with football, or it's baseball, we're starting with the top story of the day. What's the hottest thing that happened? And there's a theme, like a format to that of like, this is the most attractive story. We start here and we go in importance of there and we make it. He's bringing in now SportsCenter has, hey, we're going to get the best journalists. We'll kick it to them, like a Peter Gammons or, you know, Mike Lupica or Mitch Albom, Bob Ryan, and they're covering the game. We're going to have them on there talking about, like, you know, what they're seeing live from the Boston Garden or Yankee Stadium or Peter Gammons or Fenway Park. So he was really the guy. All those anchors say he turned it around, and the SportsCenter that we grew to see and love came from John Walsh's mind.
And it's like, that's this such a great story of sort of where the rest of us were at in that era of, you know, and the same thing could happen for like kids with Nickelodeon. You know, when Nickelodeon first was introduced, it was slow and sluggish and not super exciting. And then they had a burst of energy thanks to a new group of producers that did the exact same thing. They're like, no, this needs to be faster, exciting. We want kids tuning in to see what happens next. We need to have shows about kids, for kids. You know, it's the kids network. And, you know, ESPN, you know, now you put it that way, it's really, it says something about how transformative the 80s really were. That we were like out with the old, in with the new. Let's, you know, fast pace everything. I mean, it's weird to think of a time, because now sports related stories will show up on the regular news too. And not even.
Absolutely.
Most of the time it's off the field stuff. It's not really the games. Sometimes contract stuff will show up, especially if it's like a big time deal that, you know, a non-sports person would be like, oh, that's interesting. But, treating sports with that kind of seriousness is, I think, a very transformational thing. It's very revolutionary for all of sportsdom, which then goes back to that first question of, because then post 87, that's even more material that you work with. You know, whenever on SportsCenter, they would do the wide shot and the anchor standing there next to a screen, then you know it's like a bigger, you know, more in-depth story. Like, you know, so-and-so sat down with, you know, Jim Everett to talk about, or, you know, about, you know, how I'm making this up, but how it's like raising golden retrievers now that he's retired. You know, it's like, I don't know if he does that. I doubt it, but, I know he punched Jim Rome, but,
yes.
Yeah. That was kind of dark time of ESPN, but, you know, it's like, that's such a, you know, so two of the SportsCenter figures, ESPN figures that I tend to zero in on the most are Steve Levy and Linda Cohn, because they both are alum of the same university I went to, and that's Oswego State University and Central New York State. And they have they're recognized there in more ways than one. Like, they have at the hockey arena, the Steve Levy press box is there, and it's actually they have a big meteorology school there, but they're also pretty decent with broadcasting too. And in fact, Al Roker is a graduate from there.
Okay.
And I always assume, because he was the weatherman for the Today Show, I'm like, oh, Al Roker must have gone to Oswego for their meteorology program. No, he went for broadcasting. Like, he became the weather reporter for a Syracuse station. That's how he got his start, but it was a broadcasting thing. So it's like, that same generation was producing people who had, like you said, the journalists that have many different talents. You know, they can cover sports, they can cover serious news, they can cover weather, they could do it all. And if we concentrate their efforts and their talents in the sports world, the fans, the viewers are going to benefit that much more. And I guess it just keeps all going back to the fact that we're having, as a society, more and more time on our hands, you know, to, you know, our lives are becoming that much more automated and easier, that we can actually give it the attention. Cause I think if you tried to do something similar, you know, even as early as like the 1960s, most people just wouldn't have time in their workday to pay attention to, like, I don't care about Mickey Mantle, you know, whatever he's doing. Like, I just want to see him play baseball, you know? That's probably why he was allowed to be the kind of hellraiser he was off the field.
Yeah.
You know, well, it wasn't on the 20-minute news cycle.
I think I think you're right, but I think it needed things to be set up. And I think it kind of is what you said about these sources taking in the culture, but influencing the culture. So I feel like it would have been looked at weird because we didn't, it was like, all they knew was those three networks. And it was like, okay, boom, boom, boom. I got Walter Cronkite, the game bet. Like they didn't know any better, but then you get to like the '80s and what I think certain people kind of got. And then that whole era, I've heard other people talk about it. When you're a journalist, but then you're for print, you know, because back then, the big thing, if you were a reporter, journalist, it was the newspaper.
Right.
And that's how you're respected. That's how you're admired. TV is a joke. That's for like the hairdos.
Yeah.
Like you're not a real journalist. And then when you started seeing A, the money that was in TV, and then B, what they got was what it comes down to, entertainment. You got to entertain. So I think that's where, if you see starting with Chris Berman and then going on to that next wave of SportsCenter anchors, Chris Berman, no, he went to Brown University. I mean, that's big time. He's a smart dude.
Yeah.
But what he got was he knew like, okay, I'm talking about sports, but what are we doing? And especially if it's 2 a.m, they want to be entertained.
Yeah.
And like they want to like laugh. They want to get something out of it. How do I entertain them? If I want to be a serious journalist, I'll go to the Washington Post or something. Mm-hmm. But when I'm on TV, we got to hook these people. We got to bring them in. And I think that's where it was huge. Like, how do we bring this audience in to watch us? Because if you just do the Yankees won 5-4 with the Red Sox, blah, 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 blah. No one's watching that. How right. do we hook people? And that was the key.
Because we needed to be hooked. We had kind of built up such a world of entertainment, and that's actually what the E in ESPN stands for, is entertainment sports. You know, it's not like it's you know, if it was just reading off the scores, you could basically have the old Weather Channel with, you know, remember the print up of the right. local, you know, and the
right.
awful music that they'd play, the Muzak that would go as your, oh, okay, it's going to be sunny today. And, you know, they could do that with the sports and just have it, here's a bunch of scores. But to add that extra bit of it, you know, we demanded that by the 80s. We didn't know maybe that we demanded it, but we needed that level of excitement in our lives and around us all the time. So it just kind of matches, you know, because when it comes to something as television that gets that instant feedback from its audience, they know to either keep going or to ditch it, right? And if people are responding well to it, let's just keep doing it, you know? And that's what we wanted. It's a definite sign of what we were interested in as sports fans.
Cable TV represents the natural progression and evolution of the medium, especially here in the United States, where the culture encourages maximizing everything. Just like the magazine titles that began springing up earlier in the century, as of the end of the 1970s, no matter what one's interest might have been, there would soon be a channel on cable TV dedicated to it. And by the 1990s, when cable was really informing kids, Jeremy and my age, it had absolutely come true. That's where we'll leave things for this week. Part 2 will be along next Wednesday. But you don't need to wait until then to hear the whole thing. Head on over to patreon.com/EPSpodcast or EPSpodcast.substack.com. And once you become a patron or a subscriber, you'll have full access to unedited audio from each episode. It would mean the world to me if you rated this podcast and followed it wherever you're listening to it right now. Following the show on social media platforms could not be any easier. Just go on over to www.everything-history.com and you'll find all the social media links right there. I'll talk to you next time on the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.